ask you to turn again to Luke's Gospel, chapter 6. We've been working through this book together, and we've come to the account of the Sermon on the Plain. In verse 17, we see Jesus standing on a level place, and he's speaking to a large crowd of his disciples. These are all people who say that they're going to follow him, that they want to learn from him. But Jesus warns them that following him isn't an easy option. He warns that if they are his real disciples, they'll find that they're poor and that they go hungry and that they weep. And especially they'll find that they'll be ill-treated and persecuted by the people around them. Jesus says in verse 22, "Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man." If you've never experienced that, if you've never been hated and excluded and insulted for the sake of Jesus, the Son of Man, then you have to question whether you're really a Christian at all, whether you're really one of his blessed people. And then Jesus goes on to tell them how they must respond when people do ill-treat them in this way. Verse 27, "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who ill-treat you." And he shows what this is going to mean in practice. Verse 29, "If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, don't stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you. If anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back." The rule for Jesus' followers is that they must treat other people not the way those people have treated them, but the way they would want those people to treat them. That's verse 31. If they're true disciples of Jesus Christ, they've got to be ridiculously, absurdly generous towards their enemies, towards people who try to hurt them, towards people who aim to harm them. Jesus says it again in verse 35. They've got to love those people. Love your enemies, he says. They've got to do good to them. They really have to commit themselves to do all the good they possibly can to people who have done nothing but harm them. They've got to lend to them, says Jesus, even though they know they'll never get it back. They've got to be prepared to be cheated by people who are totally ungrateful and who will just take advantage of their kindness. Now, in the eyes of the world, living like this may be stupid. But Jesus says that's the way you have got to live if you want to be one of his disciples. And why must you live like this? Well, the answer is simply this: because God does. And that's what we were thinking about last week. If you belong to Jesus Christ, then you are a child of God. And children are supposed to resemble their parents. Children are expected to copy their parents. Well, how does God treat people who ill-treat him? Jesus gives us the answer at the end of verse 35. He is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. As long as people live in this world, God is incredibly, amazingly kind to them. Even the most wicked people, even the most ungrateful people, He's constantly looking after them. He's constantly caring for them. He's constantly providing for them. He keeps them alive from moment to moment. He keeps their heart pumping blood. He keeps their lungs breathing. He keeps their brain functioning. He gives them food. He makes the sun shine on them. Every time they cut their finger, he heals the cut. He makes the skin grow over again. And he does this for people who ignore him and people who actively hate him. He does this for people who spend their whole lives blaspheming him and insulting him. I said it last week. Take the most evil man in the world, the most perverted paedophile, or the most brutal dictator. Take a Stalin or take a Hitler. And up to the last moment of their God-hating, disgusting lives, God was showing kindness to them. A few minutes before he died, Hitler took a drink, and he felt a moment of pleasure as the drink trickled down his throat. And that was one last gift that God gave him. God kept his taste buds working to the end, so that that evil man could experience one more moment of pleasure. God was giving him good gifts right up to the last breath he drew. And God does this for every single human being here in this world. A man may spend year after year living the most foul, gross life imaginable, sneering at God, never showing one moment of gratitude to God for anything, misusing every good gift that God gives him. And yet God still carries on giving that man good gifts. Oh yes, God may mix in with those good gifts many troubles and pains and hurts. But even those are God's acts of kindnesses, because he sends them as warnings. He sends them to show sinners that they're in danger. And along with them, he carries on doing kind and gracious things for every sinner. You know, the next time someone complains about their life and asks you angrily why God allowed such and such to happen to them, you just remind them of some of the kindness God has shown to them and ask why he's done that. What they've done for God to deserve it. Ask, why has God kept your eyes working? You never use them to read his book. You only ever use them to watch television. Why has God been so kind to you to keep those eyes working day after day, year after year? What have you done to deserve the gift of eyesight? Ask them that question. Ask them, why has God protected you every time you've gone out in your car? You've been careless lots of times, haven't you? And other drivers around you have been careless. So why didn't God let you die? What have you done to deserve his protection? When people are talking about the unhappinesses that they've experienced and blaming God for them, remind them of the countless ways in which God has protected them every day of their life, for which they've never thanked him. The fact is that God carries on day after day being incredibly, amazingly generous to people who have never done anything to deserve it and who have never shown a scrap of gratitude. They complain when something goes wrong, but they never notice that there are hundreds of days when God makes sure that nothing goes wrong for them. Never think of thanking God for those days. And yet God puts up with their selfishness and ungratefulness, and he carries on caring for them as long as they're here in this world. So Jesus says to his disciples, if you want to be God's children, then you're going to have to behave the way God your Father does. If he can carry on showing kindness and love for people like that, so can you. Or rather, it's not a case of so can you. Whether you can or not, you must, says Jesus. It is not for you or me to go around dividing people into two groups. Ah, well, I think these people deserve my love, and these people don't. I'm going to try to show kindness to these people because I think they're basically decent and deserving, but I'm not going to bother with these people. God doesn't draw those sorts of lines. He draws a line between his own children, the people who belong to Jesus Christ, and everyone else. He's got a special love for his own children. That's true. And we're allowed to have that as well, a special love for those who belong to us in a special way. But apart from his own special children, those who have trusted themselves to Christ, when you look at the human race in general, there are no lines in the way that God treats them. God shows kindness to every single one of them. God gives them all good gifts. God provides them all with things to enjoy. And that's what your goal has to be too. That's what Jesus means when he says in verse 37, "Do not judge, and you will not be judged." You know, those three words, "do not judge," have so often been pulled out of context, and they've been twisted to mean all sorts of things they don't mean. But when you realize that they follow straight on from verse 36, you can see straight away what Jesus is saying. Jesus is simply saying, you don't look at people and decide whether they deserve your kindness, your care, your friendship. You give it regardless. Even if they're people who have harmed you, people who have hurt you, people you know are ungrateful and selfish, it's not for you to judge whether they're worthy or not. As I say, Jesus' words have often been twisted to mean what they don't mean. In fact, almost the opposite of what they mean. Sometimes they're quoted, I've heard them used often this way, to prove that a church should never disapprove of false teachers or speak out against false teachers. So if I were to stand up and say that the Jehovah's Witnesses are a dangerous cult, or if I were to say that the Roman Catholic Church is wrong when it teaches we should pray to Mary, some people would come up to me and say, Jesus said, don't judge. You shouldn't be judging those people. Or the words are used to prove that we should never speak out about any pattern of behavior. So if a Christian preacher were to say, homosexual behavior is wrong, it's a perversion of nature, then he may very well get people shouting in protest, Jesus said, don't judge. If a vicar refuses to marry two people who are living in adultery, well, there'll be letters in the local press, won't there, saying, I thought Christians weren't supposed to judge. You see, these words are twisted to mean that we should never disapprove of anything that anybody says or anybody does or anything that anybody believes. Well, clearly Jesus can't mean that, because he himself spent so much time warning people that their behavior was wicked. He warned people again and again that God would throw people into hell if they didn't repent. Now, what Jesus is saying is simply that his disciples can't judge people and decide whether or not to show them kindness. We may disapprove of their beliefs. We may disapprove of their behavior. They may have hurt us. They may be the nastiest and most ungrateful people around. But we still make it our goal to show that we care for them, just as God does. I can say that Roman Catholics are wrong in praying to Mary. It's a delusion. And yet still give my loving support to that lonely Roman Catholic lady who lives across the road. I can say that homosexual behavior is wrong, sinful, and still treat that gay man as a friend and invite him into my home to have a meal with the family. If there's a foul-mouthed, brutal man living in my street who gets drunk every night and then uses my front garden as a toilet, I don't have to pretend that I think his behavior is acceptable. It's not acceptable. But I can still treat him as a friend. And if he finishes up in court for his antisocial behavior, or if he finishes up in a rehab unit for his drinking, I can be there to support him. I can visit him when nobody else is interested in the mess he's got himself into. Jesus isn't saying don't judge people's behavior. He's saying don't judge people. Don't draw lines and say, I'm going to care for people in this group, but not for people in that group. Followers of Jesus Christ, children of God, are called to care for everyone. Yeah, it's true that caring for everyone may well involve warning them when their behavior is wicked. Maybe no one else will care enough for them to look them straight in the eye and tell them the truth about themselves. Sometimes caring for them means that we've got to do that. Caring for them may mean at times taking steps to try and prevent them from carrying on with their evil behavior. I can care for a man and still report him to the police at times. It may mean at times taking direct action. I may need to prevent them from doing harm to other people. But whatever steps we have to take, our thought is still, I'm for this person, not against him. Yes, he's been against me. He's been trying to hurt me. He's been trying to hurt my family. But I'm still for him. I want to do him good. I want to care for him. I want to treat him as a real friend should. You don't draw lines between the people who deserve your friendship and the people who don't. You don't make that judgment, says Jesus. After all, if God were to draw that line, which side of the line would you be on yourself? Supposing God were to say, right, from now on, every time Stephen or Jeff or Rose or Carol or Stuart or whoever, every time Stephen treats me badly, I'm going to take note. I'll overlook it once and still carry on caring for Stephen. I'll put up with it twice and I'll still carry on caring for Stephen. But three strikes and he's out. At that point, Stephen will have made it perfectly clear that he doesn't deserve my kindness. And from there on, he can't expect anything from me. If God were to take that line, where would that leave me? Or any of us? Is there an hour that goes by when I don't hurt God in some way? When I don't wrong him in one way or another? By breaking one or another of his kind commandments? Or by failing to show gratitude for his kindness? Or by misusing one of his gifts? Or by wasting the resources he's given me, including my time, my energy? If God were to draw a line and judge me and decide whether or not I deserved his kindness, I know which side of the line I'd be on. You know, if someone, say a neighbour, did me down three times, cheated me, stole from me, I'd think I was being really generous if I still showed that neighbour kindness. But God has carried on showing me kindness day after day, week after week, year after year, after I've hurt him, wronged him millions of times. He's kept me safe on thousands of car journeys when the brakes could have failed. He's provided me with tens of thousands of meals. He's given me countless friends. He's given me my wife and my children. He's kept them alive for me till today. He's kept my eyes working and my ears working, even most of the time my knee working. If God had judged me and asked, "Is Stephen worthy of my kindness?" I'd have had none of those things. But God hasn't done that. So Jesus says, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. And there's the word of warning. If you start measuring people, deciding which of them are worthy of your kindness, and condemning, writing off those who aren't, God may do the same to you. So Jesus says, if you don't want God to judge you, then you don't judge other people. If you don't want God to write you off, then you don't write them off. Forgive, says Jesus, and you'll be forgiven. Jesus is warning his disciples that God will take the same attitude to us as we take to the people who hurt us and harm us, who offend us, who persecute us. If we want God to forgive us, then we're going to have to forgive them. And if we want God to keep on forgiving us, then we're going to have to keep on forgiving them. Verse 38, give and it will be given to you. If we want God to keep on giving to us, then we're going to have to keep giving to them, giving them our time and our sympathy and our friendship, and if they needed our money. And we're going to have to keep giving, even when we don't get anything back in return, even gratitude. Because often we don't give God anything in return for his kindness. And yet we want him to keep on giving to us. How generous is God? How generous are we called to be? If we're imitators of God, children of God. Jesus gives us a graphic picture in verse 38. He says, a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. Imagine a beggar. He's sitting in the marketplace, cross-legged. And he doesn't have a cap for people to throw coins into. Instead, he's just spread out a larger cloth, maybe his own cloak, across his lap. And he's hoping people will give him food. Well, some people toss a bit of vegetable or an apple or a slice of bread into the cloak that's spread over his lap. But then a man comes over with a sack of grain and he begins to pour it into the beggar's lap. And he just keeps pouring. And the cloth is full. The cloak is full to the brim. The beggar's holding up the sides. And then the beggar shakes it so that the grain settles. And then he presses the grain down with his hands. So now there's a bit more space left at the top. And then the giver carries on pouring. And the beggar shakes it down again. And then he presses down the grain again. And there's still more room in the cloth. And so the giver carries on pouring. And this time he carries on until the grain is overflowing over the edge of the cloth. He's given as much as it's possible to give. Well, Jesus says, that's the way my disciples can expect God to give to them, a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be poured into your lap. You can expect God to be that generous with you. But first, that's the way you must expect to give to other people. Because with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Do you see what Jesus is saying? When God gives to us, he doesn't give to us just the bare minimum that he can get away with. He doesn't just give us the bare minimum we can expect, the bare minimum that we need for survival. He doesn't even give us just what we asked for. He gives and he gives and he gives, never asking how much do we deserve, asking instead, what do they need? And what would be good for them? You know, that is the only limit God puts on what he gives to his children. He won't give us more than is good for us. But he'll give us as much as a wise father possibly can give. You know, every wise father knows that he mustn't give his children too much, doesn't he? One of my children asks for a fifth helping of jelly and ice cream, well, then I'll probably say no. Not because I don't want them to be happy, but because I know what the effect would be. If a 15-year-old asks for his pocket money to be raised from £5 a week to £5,000 a week, even if his dad has that money to give, dad will probably say no. Not because he doesn't want his son to enjoy life, because he knows his son isn't capable yet of handling that sort of money. It would only harm him. It would expose him to temptation. Well, there are things that God won't give us because they would harm us. He won't give me perfect health because it would make me too self-confident and it would make me forget that this life is short. He won't give me popularity and he won't give me fame unless he's sure I could cope with it without becoming vain. There are lots of things God doesn't give us because he knows we couldn't cope with them. But when I look at what God does give me, I'm just astonished by that incredible generosity. A measure of health. So many friends. A church to care for me. A country where there's freedom, safety day after day. Books to read and music to listen to and hymns to sing and the Bible to enrich my soul and a wife to love me and children to love and a garden to sit in and hills to walk in and curries to tickle my taste buds. Fulfilling work to do every day of my life. Generous? This God has poured good things into my lap. They've been shaken down and they've been pressed down and still they run over. He gives me more good gifts than I can count. He gives me more than I can even use to the full. And I've not deserved any one of them. All I deserve, I know what I deserve. I know that I deserve to hear the terrible voice of Jesus the judge saying, "Depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels." That's what I deserve. I deserve to face the wrath of a holy God whom I've offended. Only he knows the dark things that have been hidden in my heart. Only he knows the things I've done in secret. Only he knows the way I've hurt him again and again and again and again. I know what I deserve. And yet there's been a boundless generosity. So shouldn't that be my standard then, when I try to decide how generous to be to other people? Especially the people who have hurt me, especially the people who have harmed me, the people I don't like, the people who don't deserve it. Like God, I may have to restrain my generosity for their sake. I may say, well, it wouldn't be good for them if I were to give them as much of my time or as much of my help as they would like to have. You know, if some neighbor asks me to cut his grass for him every week, even though he's perfectly capable of doing it himself, I'm going to say no. But that's not because it's too much to ask. It's not because it would be too much generosity. It's because it wouldn't be good for him to be allowed to become even more lazy than he is. But as far as my willingness to give goes, I've got to be like the giver in Jesus' picture here, pouring the grain in, shaking it down, pressing it down till it's running over, and still willing to give more. Jesus adds a further picture. A parable, Luke calls it. It runs like this. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Won't they both fall into a pit? What point is Jesus making? Well, he's saying this. You can't, you mustn't demand that other people reach a certain standard before you try to show kindness to them. With anything, you've got to be doing it yourself before you can expect somebody else to do it. Imagine a blind man. He's trying to lead someone else, another blind man, from point A to point B. But he can't get from point A to point B himself. Well, unless he's capable of doing it himself first, there's no point in trying to help someone else to do it. Do you see Jesus' point? Here you've got one of his disciples saying, well, yes, I'll teach other people to be kind and generous and friendly. And when they are, I'll be kind and generous and friendly to them. Jesus says, no, you've got to be capable of going on ahead of them, of being kind and generous and friendly yourself first. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to take other people there. And he adds, a student isn't above his teacher. You can lecture other people as long as you want about how kind and generous and caring they should be. But if you're not being that sort of person yourself, all your lectures are going to be pointless. The student isn't going to finish up doing more than the teacher does. He's not going to finish up behaving better than you yourself. You've got to go first. You've got to live that life of self-sacrificing, generous love first. And then maybe your students will listen to your lessons. Just as everyone who's fully trained will be like his teacher. You take the lead. You live this sort of life. You love people who don't deserve it, who deserve the opposite. And maybe you'll turn them round. Maybe if you persevere with these unwilling students, if you stick the course to the end, then they will finish up being like you, their student, their teacher. But it's got to be that way round. Do you see the logic of what Jesus is saying? God showed love to these disciples of his when they didn't deserve it. And they've responded to that love. And now they're learning to be like God. They've become his students. They're learning from him. So they must now show love to other people who don't deserve it. And who knows, among those people there may be some who are willing to learn from them. There may be some who will respond to that love, who will repent, who will be transformed. Maybe there'll be some who will become disciples of Jesus themselves, children of God, just because they've seen the impossible, generous, awesome love of God displayed in the people who are already Jesus' disciples. Maybe when you finished teaching them the lesson and they're fully trained, teaching them not just by what you say, but by what you are and by what you do, then maybe the pupils will be like the teacher. Well, we're coming to an end. Those of you who are disciples of Jesus, those of you who have realized how badly you've treated God. Those of you who have been convicted by the Holy Spirit and you've been forced to the point of admitting that you don't deserve anything from God. Those of you who have come to Jesus Christ with empty hands to take forgiveness and peace as a gift from Him, bought by His own bloody death. Those of you who have been joined to Jesus Christ now and who are following Him, trusting Him, those of you who are disciples of Jesus, what are you going to do about this? Do you remember a few weeks back, I challenged you. I said, make a list of people you don't like. People who have hurt you, people who have harmed you. People maybe who have had it in for you because you belong to Jesus Christ. Make that list. And then I suggested that you should write down against each name just how you're going to go about doing what Jesus says you've got to do for those people. How are you going to love that enemy? That woman who's told all those lies about you. How are you going to do good to that man who's made your life a misery? What are you going to do to bless that person who cursed you? What are you going to be praying for the people who have been so nasty to you? I suggested to you then that you should be specific about this. That instead of just saying, oh yes, it's a good thing to love people, even nasty people, that you should actually write down what that's going to mean for you and how you're going to go about it. Well, you've had 3 weeks now, or however long it's been. Have you made a start? Have you actually been doing these things? Have there been people you put on the list 3 weeks ago, and now you can say, yes, I've had the opportunity to show love to that person. I've done it by God's grace. It's all very well reading these words. It's all very well my preaching about them. It's all very well agreeing, well, yes, that's what Jesus says. But the question is, have I and have you actually been doing what Jesus told us to do? In a couple of weeks' time, we're going to come to that very familiar passage which the children sing about in Sunday school. The wise man built his house upon a rock. The foolish man built his house upon the sand. And you know what that passage is all about? It's a passage where Jesus warns us about the danger of listening to his commands but never getting round actually to doing them. He says, a man who listens to my commands and actually does them, well, he's like a man who builds a house on a rock, on a solid foundation. That house will be safe. That man will be safe, even though the storms come and batter on that house. That man's safe forever. But he says, a person who listens to my words and maybe nods and takes notes on them and says, oh yes, that was very good, wasn't it? But doesn't actually do them, that man is like a man who builds his house just on sand. It may look fine, but the moment there's a storm, the moment there are floods, it'll be swept away. We've been listening to the words of the Lord Jesus over these past weeks, telling us that we have to love our enemies, not just in our heads or in our hearts, but that we've got to actually go and do good to them. We've actually got to go and speak blessing to them. We've actually got to get down on our knees and pray for them. We've been hearing Jesus Christ saying these things. But have we actually got round to doing anything about that? Have we been building a house on rock? Have we been building it on sand?